coffee or bring flowers for our ancestors. If you'd like to donate food, call 604-649-5556. And otherwise, just come down and spend some time with us and hold up the sign and show your support. We'd really appreciate it. Thank you. Haichka.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, June 8th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Iqbal Ahmed. You are listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building here at the University of British Columbia, to our campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:10 p.m. and time for another almost full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We'll also be talking to Claire Robson from Quirky, Jeff Mearman from the TD Bank Group, as well as Ben West from the Wilderness Committee.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. Now it's time for your local headlines.
The elusive snakehead fish in Burnaby Central Park Lagoon was finally caught Friday after previous attempts failed to capture the invasive critter. The creature became the subject of an extensive hunt that turned up empty-handed until provincial government officials partially drained the pond. A snakehead has been caught, said Suntana Dalal, a spokesman at BC Ministry of Environment, but the team that has been out there is going to keep looking a bit longer to make sure there aren't any more. Snakeheads are native to China and can grow up to 1 meter in length. Dubbed Fishzilla by National Geographic, the animals have no natural predators outside of their natural environment and are capable of traveling short distances over land by wriggling on the ground to new habitats. Officials are also planning to destroy all non-native and invasive species found in the Central Park Lagoon as a preventative measure.
British Columbia's biggest sector, a public sector union, says contract talks with the provincial government are deadlocked and has warned of a strike if mediation fails. The union president, Daryl Walker, says that the two sides are still far from a deal and is hoping a third-party mediator can bring them closer together. The union has said it would like to exhaust all options, but if mediations fail, they will consider a strike, which would include clerical staff and liquor store employees to jail guards and social workers, among others. The government has offered a 3% pay increase over 2 years, but the union is holding out for more, including a cost of living increase, saying its members haven't had a raise in almost 3 years.
A second civic politician in Vancouver is making a bid for a provincial NDP nomination. Two-term city councillor Jeff Meggs has announced he will seek the NDP nomination in the Vancouver Fairview riding, currently held by Liberal Margaret McDermid. Meggs won't be acclaimed in the riding because former BC Government and Service Employees Union President George Heyman is also seeking the nod. The successful NDP candidate will be selected at a meeting on October 21st. Meggs' announcement comes just days after Park Board Commissioner Constance Barnes confirmed she will run for the NDP nomination in Vancouver Falls Creek, currently held by Liberal Mary McNeil. Barnes made her announcement last weekend and revealed she will step down as Park Board Chairwoman in order to focus on her bid, but Meg says he'll remain on council until he knows if he has won the right to represent New Democrats in next May's provincial election.
Those are UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for local weather forecasts as well as provincial and national headlines.
Since 1963, the Vancouver Aboriginal Friendship Centre Society has been meeting the needs of Aboriginal people making the transition to urban Vancouver. The Friendship Centre provides programs in health, welfare, and equality, and has made its goal to help Aboriginal families, youth, adults, elders, and children access health information and education and maintain their Aboriginal cultural ties and values. For more information or to volunteer, visit us at 1607 East Hastings Street or online at www.vacfs.org. Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us, and it's now time for your provincial and national headlines.
Several dozen people condemned the Formula One racing circuit at a human rights demonstration being held in Montreal, just a few meters away from a Grand Prix party Friday night. Participants were trying to call attention to pro-democracy demonstrations in Bahrain, and they criticized the racing circuit's role in that country. One activist from Bahrain addressed a crowd remaining in that officials had went ahead with a race there in April despite harsh repression by the government. He said activists were being killed as races went on. He said he was heartened by Montreal protests this week, said Nasser Alwa, an Ottawa man who said he was arrested and tortured in Bahrain last year. Quote, "It's a stand that's appreciated by the people of Bahrain. The people of Bahrain felt much abandoned by the Western countries. Sports should support human rights first," end quote. The Montreal demonstration was being monitored by a heavy police presence. Security is far tighter than usual in Montreal this weekend, as the Grand Prix festivities have formed a focal point in protest movement that has flared up in Quebec over recent months. There is a notable police presence in the subway system, which some protesters were promised to disrupt on Sunday's race day.
The federal NDP has a slight edge over the Conservatives, but the two parties are statistically neck and neck, a new poll suggests. According to the poll released Friday by Nanos Research, 33.6% of respondents support the NDP, compared with 33.5% who support the Conservatives. Liberals came in third with 24% of respondents supporting the party, while the Bloc Québécois had 3.4% of respondents support and the Green Party 2.4%. Nano says it's the first time in its tracking history that the NDP has numerically surpassed the Tories. The poll randomly surveyed 1,201 Canadians aged 18 or older between May 26 and 31st and had a margin of error of plus or minus 2.8% 19 out of 20 times, or plus or minus 3.1% 19 times out of 20 for 1,006 committed voters. The NDP's slight lead comes despite attacks on party leader Thomas Mulcair, who argue that Canada's thriving economy, thriving energy exports, fueled largely by the oil sands, have created an artificially high dollar, which in turn has tanked the manufacturing sector. Economists call the phenomenon Dutch disease. The Conservatives pounce on Mulcair for his views, painting him as an ill-informed and divisive leader who ultimately holds anti-West sentiments. In regional breakdowns, 24.7% of respondents in the Prairies said they support the NDP, compared to 50.2% who support the Tories. The NDP had the strongest support in Quebec, with 41.5% of respondents claiming support.
A group of BC teens and young adults who dressed up as superheroes to target internet predators has seen their efforts pay off after charges were laid against three men. Members of the group used the internet to portray themselves as 15-year-old girls having conversations with adult men. They were lured the men to public places where someone in a superhero costume would berate the suspects for trying to pick up teenage girls online for sex. Chilliwack RCMP became aware of the superhero sting last November and took over the investigation after warning the young vigilantes their actions put themselves at risk and jeopardized possible convictions. Police now say three Fraser Valley men have been charged with child luring and will appear for separate court dates over the next 6 weeks.
After a dozen years of support, the federal government has decided to pull funding from a marketing co-op for independent Canadian publishers. The Literary Press Group, or LPG, which represents 47 members, including BC's Talon Books and Anvil Press, lost federal funding June 4th in an unexpected decision by the Department of Canadian Heritage. The move means that budding authors of alternative poetry, fiction, and nonfiction will have a much harder time getting their work on bookstore and library shelves, said LPG director Jack Illingworth. The group has fired 6 of 8 staff as a result of the cuts, he said. Former LPG members will likely find that they no longer get the same attention they had under a bigger marketer with more clients. Some publishers may have to stop selling books. Between 2011 and 2012, the federal government provided the LPG with roughly $250,000 in funding. Illingworth said his organization had little warning of the impending cuts other than the June 2011 statement by Federal Finance Minister Jim Flaherty. Flaherty told the CBC cultural institutions could no longer rely on the federal government for funds. The LPG currently plans to continue representing nearly 225 titles this upcoming fall season. After that, however, without additional funding, Illingworth said he will have to try to arrange independent agents for member publishers.
Those are provincial and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your international news and your local weather forecast for this weekend.
Ski and Snowboard Club is a non-profit, democratic, student-run organization dedicated to promoting the sports of skiing and snowboarding and the associated lifestyle.
We endeavor to make skiing and snowboarding accessible and fun by actively seeking out the best deals and discounts for our members, as well as organizing trips to local ski areas and setting up numerous social events.
Come on one of our legendary trips and explore the glory of riding in British Columbia. Or join us at the bar to discover the true meaning of debauchery. Ask your roommate, ask your parents, ask the RCMP. Who has the most fun at UBC? You'll get the same answer. The Ski and Snowboard Club.
Yeah. Joining the Ski and Board Club is easy. Come by our office, sub 115, anytime with some money to become a member. Your membership gives you access to all the deals offered by our sponsors, cheap beverages at our parties, an invitation to all club events, and of course, only members can come on the trips. Yeah.
If you have an approaching test or exam and need help studying, well, it's time to prepare yourself. The Study Van, www.studyvan.com, is a 100% free website dedicated to helping you achieve excellence. MCAT, History, Chemistry, French, Math, Biology, the Study Van covers it all. Tools are provided so you can create your own study group and do what you need to do. Ace your exam. The Study Van will help you help yourself. Give it a shot, you have nothing to lose, as once again it is a 100% free studying resource. So remember, when you need to study, go to the Study Van, www.studyban.com.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. This is News 101. And next on News 101, we go to an interview by Claire Eagle.
So I'm joined right now by Ben West from the Wilderness Committee. Ben is the Healthy Communities Campaigner for the Wilderness Committee, and he's here to talk with me today about the recent Red Deer River oil spill and the impact this could have on BC. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm not too bad.
So welcome to the show. Obviously, the Red Deer River spill isn't the biggest spill that we've seen recently, but it is quite sizable. So what can you tell us about that spill?
Well, I mean, this is just yet another oil spill that's happened in the midst of this, extremely controversial set of proposals around exporting tar sands oil in through British Columbia. The spill in Red Deer, is kind of just a story that broke really yesterday. Authorities first started hearing about it at some point yesterday when people started smelling, something that really stunk bad, like rotten eggs, I think was what one of the people who actually smelled it, was reporting. And often this is what we see happen with oil spills is, the company actually finds out about it because people start smelling something awful. And of course the oil is extremely toxic. It's now spilled into some tributaries of a river system, which because they've had heavy rain in Alberta, there's some fear that this might actually flood into surrounding communities, and there's already some homes that have been affected and potentially drinking water that's just down the river from where this spill took place. So, I mean, it's something like a 3,000 barrel spill, which, in the grand scheme of things is actually relatively small, although it's definitely enough to have a huge impact on people's lives who live close to it. This is happening, you know, not long after actually one of the biggest spills in the history of Alberta has just recently taken place in further north in the province close to the territories.
Right, and yeah, and I think even more recently there was a smaller one as well, just in probably a couple of weeks ago of, I think up near Rainbow Lake there was another 5,000 barrel one, if that's
yeah,
correct.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's pretty mind-boggling how many spills we've seen happen in mm-hmm. a short period of time, and of course these things do happen on a relatively regular basis, although, you know, people are definitely noticing a lot more because of the context of the Enbridge pipeline discussion and the Kinder Morgan mm-hmm. pipeline discussion.
Yeah, so bringing it to that, I mean, obviously these spills are all happening in Alberta and having a huge impact on the ecosystems there and the people there. What kind of impact do you think that news like this will have, if any, on the negotiations for the Northern Gateway Pipeline or the Kinder Morgan project?
Well, I mean, really, those conversations are sort of a public relations battle trying to get the people of British Columbia to support these projects. You know, the Enbridge and Kinder Morgan are spending tremendous amounts of money hiring public relations firms trying to sort of sell their pipelines as safe and good for the economy and, you know, and a positive thing. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, there's environmentalists and First Nations and others who are actively trying to sort of raise awareness and raise alarm. You know, often when we talk about pipeline spills and tanker spills, we say it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And, you know, and seeing these kinds of spills happening, you know, just adds fuel to the fire, so as to speak, in terms of that sort of level of awareness, level of concern, mm-hmm. You know, where people can actually see what an oil spill looks like, and we can sort of imagine, you know, how bad that would be if it happened, say, in the Fraser River or, you know, in some of the tributaries of the Fraser or elsewhere in the province where, you know, the impacts would be really severe.
And obviously, as you were saying, this is only adding fuel to that fire, and there already is a significant amount of opposition to these projects. Do you expect that seeing these differences or these new spills will force the companies to change their strategies at all, or will it still be a selling battle?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about these pipeline ruptures is, you know, the concern around oil tankers is really, really far-reaching. I mean, you know, because of the ExxonMobil's and the big BP mm-hmm. disaster, you know, we've become really aware of sort of offshore threats, mm-hmm. you know, kind of coastal threats. In particular, the ExxonMobil's has had a huge impact on the way that we look at oil tankers. And when you look at the polling results, people are overwhelmingly concerned about export via tanker. They're right. less concerned about pipelines.
Right.
But I think as we see these pipeline ruptures increasingly, you know, right here in Canada, let alone elsewhere in the world, you know, I think it makes people wake up even more to the concerns around pipelines as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in terms of what the companies will have to do, well, I think it just changes their public relations strategy. They now have to fight even harder to talk about pipeline safety as well as tanker safety, which are really totally separate but connected issues. Will they change the routing of their pipeline or anything like that? I doubt it. Does it change the fact that the government of Canada under Harper is clearly, you know, quite dedicated to pushing these projects through? I mean, that's not going to change. Mm-hmm. In fact, nobody's really doubting that the government's going to give permits to these projects. I think really what might change is, you know, how much of a vote determining issue these issues are in the next provincial and federal election. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and if a government came in that was, you know, eager to sort of stop these projects, as the provincial NDP has made it clear that they are, that really could have huge implications on whether these projects ever get built or not. And, of course, the next federal election might seem like a long way away, but we're likely to have another federal election before, you know, either one of these projects even actually gets underway in terms of being built.
Yeah, it definitely is interesting because I think it did start out as a much more of an environmental concern that people may not have been as aware about, but definitely ballooned into something that's much bigger. And I think general public awareness is huge right now, and there definitely is a lot of that opposition. It's very interesting to see it morph into a very political issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just touching again on what you said about it being concerned more about the pipeline spills as opposed to offshore spills, do you see public awareness of that changing? And do you think that would help get more people on board with the opposition for this in the future?
Yeah, I do see that changing. I mean, I think the level of awareness of the risks of pipelines is definitely growing. You know, there's been so much talk of pipelines recently because of the Keystone XL pipeline and the Enbridge pipeline sort of just becoming massive, massive news stories, and now the Kinder Morgan's proposal is also starting to pick up steam in terms of people's awareness of it. You know, so I do think that that's important, that people sort of understand that pipelines have their own sort of very unique and specific sets of threats. you know, that we, it's not just the tankers we have to be worried about, you know, and it's not just the coastal communities, like the people who, you know, live directly along the coast who have reasons to be concerned, but also, you know, all the people who live along the pipeline route, you know, even if it's not going directly through your backyard, if you're in the general vicinity of it, there definitely is, you know, significant reason for concern. And I think it's important that, that all the people in those so-called front lines communities are kind of aware of those concerns.
Yeah. Well, it was great talking to you today, Ben. For our listeners, is there any, what specifically could they do right now if they want to learn more about either the Red Deer River spill or get more involved with the opposition to the Enbridge pipeline?
Well, on our website, the wildernesscommittee.org site, we have a wildernesscommittee.org/tankers page where we talk about you know, all the sort of risks of the proposed pipeline expansion and tanker projects in the province. And we'll also find, you know, the press release that we just put out about what's going on with Red Deer. So, I mean, that's a good place to start. And if you're interested in getting involved, we have a sign-up list on our website at that same page, wildernesscommittee.org/tankers, where you can sign up to get action alert updates. And as these different campaigns kind of roll out, there's various different things that need to be done and lots of different ways people can get involved. So we definitely need all the help we can get. And if you're out there listening and you're interested in getting involved, you can find me on Facebook or Twitter too. That's, you know, and we can just talk about it there, or you can sign up for action alerts and you can decide which things you want to take on.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Ben. It was definitely very informative talking to you today.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So once again, that was Ben West from the Wilderness Committee talking to us about the recent Red Deer River oil spill in Alberta and the impact that may or may not have on the Enbridge pipeline projects and also the Kinder Morgan expansion here in BC. So we're going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us for more international headlines as well as more local stories.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Claire Eagle, and although we could not be joined today by our resident weatherman, Phil Chang, we're joined by our resident in training weatherman, Iqbal Ahmed, who will give us a reading of the weather from Environment Canada.
Yes.
From Environment Canada. Thank you, Environment Canada.
Well, thank you for the introduction, Claire. It's always a pleasure to fill Phil's very large shoes. And so the weather this weekend. Tonight we will see mainly cloudy with 40% chance of showers, a risk of thunderstorms early this evening, and a low of 9 degrees. Saturday, mainly cloudy, becoming windy in the morning with a high of 17, but watch out, or don't watch out, the UV index is 6 or higher. Saturday night, partly cloudy, low of 10. Sunday, cloudy, high of 17. Monday, cloudy with 40% chance of showers, low of 12, high of 19. Tuesday, cloudy again with a 30% chance of showers, low of 12, high of 20. Wednesday, cloudy, low of 11, high of 20. And Thursday, can you guess what the weather will be Thursday?
Cloudy.
Yes, you're right, Claire Eagle. Thursday will be cloudy with 30% chance of showers, low of 11, high of 19. I'd hate to be the bearer of bad news, but it sounds like we're going to have a cloudy week ahead of us. Thank you, Claire.
Thank you, Iqbal, for giving us a report of some more continuing January weather. Whoever invented that phrase was had a lot of foresight, but it was also really depressing. So I guess we'll leave our weather behind and go on to some more local stories. So now we go to a story about the BC credit and savings habits that I did with Jeff Meerman from TD earlier this week. Budget is never easy. And And especially now with the variety of financing options that people face, often they find it even more difficult than in the past to stick to balanced budget. So to go in depth on a study that TD Bank just released on British Columbians financing life's firsts with credit, we talked to Jeff Meerman, a spokesperson from TD. Hi, Jeff. So can you tell us about this study?
TD Bank Group commissioned a report. It was to conduct an online omnibus survey of about 1,000 Canadians. The responses were collected, and it was asking questions about debt and savings. Essentially, what we want to do is we wanted to ask Canadians and British Columbians what their thoughts were on savings and debt. And one of the most important things we learned about residents in BC is that half of BC residents find it difficult to enjoy life while balancing their current debt and saving for the future.
Knowing that they don't seem to be as comfortable with using credit, what are some alternatives that British Columbians are using?
Yeah, so before I answer that, just to let you know, one of the key findings was that 42% of BC residents do find it a real struggle or even impossible to save to cover some of those major purchases. And in a lot of cases, they may rely on loans, lines of credit, or even credit cards. The advice that we're giving British Columbians is that the best thing to do in terms of financing life's first would be to save as much of a down payment as possible. And that will help reduce the amount that you have to pay back over time. I just wanted to shed a little bit of a personal color onto this story, and I wanted to use myself as an example. When I graduated from university and I got my first job, one of the biggest purchases I had to make was to purchase my first car. It was, for me, probably the biggest purchase I had ever had to make in my life. So, you know, it was very scary, and, you know, when you come out of school, you don't have a lot of savings. You don't have a lot of money to work with.
You're no, definitely not.
Job. So what had happened was I did talk to my lender about some of the options about financing what was essentially a life's first, my first car. And the best advice that I got was to put as much money as I could on the down payment as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad I did that because, you know, I had that $2,000 that I didn't really want to spend on that car. I just wanted to finance the whole thing. But the recommendation was to take that down payment and put it towards the car. And it actually made the payments over time much less, and I was able to actually pay off that car much quicker.
Yeah, and that leads into one of my next questions. That was your experience with buying one of your life's first. And do you think that young people nowadays are equipped with that same knowledge of spending the most they can on a down payment?
I believe they are. I believe people do know that having a large down payment is a really important thing. Sometimes the question is, how much should I put down? And we do provide some recommendations of what people should put down. Say for a car. Let's say you want to save for a car. Our recommendation is to aim for at least 20% of the amount. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Larger down payments will ultimately lower your monthly payments and allow you to stay on budget. And, you know, some of those other unexpected expenses that come up, it'll be easier to take those down.
And just to wrap up, I know we talked about how this is a lot about British Columbians being least likely in the country to be comfortable financing life's first with credit. Did you look at all at other major purchases other than life's first?
Yeah, so we looked at some other areas as well. So not only financing a home or a car, but we also asked British Columbians about how they would finance post-secondary education or even starting a family. So,
mm-hmm.
So you know, having your first child, you know, the cost involved in that, or even paying for a wedding or honeymoon.
Mm-hmm.
There were some interesting findings there. You know, the average cost of a wedding in Canada is about $20,000.
Wow.
When talking to British Columbians, we learned that newlyweds tend to reach out to their family and friends or even secure a loan or a line of credit to cover the cost of that big day. Planning a wedding can be really fun and can be exciting,
mm-hmm.
but it's also a huge expense,
mm-hmm.
and it is really important to review finances and set a realistic budget. So the two things we talk about in financing life first would be, A, have a large down payment if you're going to take out a loan, and B, set a budget. Mm-hmm. So if you have a realistic budget and you stick to it, then it won't be such a huge accumulated debt to be that you'll be paying off for years.
Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us. It was good talking to you, Jeff.
No problem.
Okay, take care.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So once again, that was Jeff Meerman, spokesperson for TD, talking to us about British Columbians' use of credit and debt, as well as good saving tips for the future. And so that was, once again, Jeff Meerman from the TD Group. And now we go to an interview with Claire Robson from Quirky, an arts collective for queer people. Come a long way in the past 50 years, even here in Canada. And there's one group here in Vancouver that focuses on uniting the queer elderly community. So today I spoke with Claire Robson, the artistic director for Quirky, which is the queer imaging and writing collective for elders. Quirky is an organization that associates people involved in the arts, so writing, theater, music, etc., who are also in the queer community and who are elderly, so who have differing perspectives on what it means to be queer, what it means to be aging. And they're putting on a queer cabaret on Wednesday, June 13th, and so I spoke to Claire today about that. Welcome to CITR, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
You're very welcome.
So, first of all, Quirky, I know it stands for Queer Imaging and Writing Collective for Elders. Can you tell me a bit about Quirky?
Absolutely. We've been meeting together for the last 6 years to make art and do shows in the out in public. We've shown out at UBC and Vancouver Public Library, the high school auditorium at Britannia, among other venues. And we call ourselves a discordant choir of unruly voices. Mm-hmm. So we all have different ideas about what it means to be old and what it means to be queer. And yet we've worked together very harmoniously for the last 6 years.
Can you give me an idea of what some of the different artistic endeavors and artistic pursuits that people in Quirky are involved look like?
Yes, we have a united project, so we work collaboratively on a different project every year. So the first year we actually made digital images in Adobe Photoshop and showed that. It was a juried show at the Vancouver Public Library Moat Gallery. Mm-hmm. We've done a theatrical show, Outspoken, which we staged at Britannia High School. Mm-hmm. We publish an anthology every year. We're up on YouTube. And this year, in fact, we're working on the second year of a two-year project. We're producing an anthology called The Bridge Generation, which is stories from the 50s to the 2000s, and really chronicle our lives in that experience of, you know, coming from no rights when being queer was pathologized, mm-hmm. to full civil rights, at least in Canada. So we feel that we're the generation that have taken that journey and that we have important stories to tell about that. So we've compiled an anthology, mainly stories, but also some graphic memoir, you know, a la Alison Bechdel and Sarah Leavitt. Graphic memoir is a very popular genre right now.
Wow, it's definitely a very interesting project. And what you're saying about being the generation that witnessed that change in rights, and it was definitely very significant. Is there diversity in background, and does this come forward at all during the memoirs that you're looking to publish?
Yes, not quite as much as we like. We're hoping actually to look a little bit more like the face of Vancouver next year. You know, we're actively seeking some queers who are people of color and who identify that way. Mm-hmm. We have a large range of age and a large range of backgrounds. We're not as ethnically diverse as we would like.
Mm-hmm. Well, moving on then to the Queer Cabaret, which is coming up next Wednesday. Is that correct? Yeah, so a week from today. What can you tell me about that?
Well, I come actually hot from our dress rehearsal this morning.
Oh, wow.
There's a huge level of excitement about the cabaret. For the first time this year, we've invited some younger queer people to join us in our annual celebration.
Mm-hmm.
It takes place at the Roundhouse Community Center. It's this coming Wednesday, so a week today. Starts at 7 p.m. And we are delighted to have two films made by people working with Out in Schools. One is called Peking Turkey by Michael Mew, and it's about somebody who takes his French-Canadian boyfriend home for Christmas. So it's, the big introducing the queer boyfriend to the family Christmas table, that kind of scenario. And the other one is called Hello, My Name is Herman by Corinne Silverwoman. And it's a really great movie. It's a relationship between a 91-year-old Jewish man and his lesbian granddaughter and her girlfriend. It's a really tender, gorgeous little short film. Then we've got a ukulele quartet, The Questions and Queries. One of our members saw them performing at Ivan Coyote's recent event and snatched them up for hours. And then we've got several members of Quirky. We've got a play called What's Hot, which is somebody's experience at Jewish summer camp, which is pretty funny, featuring a quartet of dancing frogs. We've got Gail Roberts, who's a trans woman, who's reading a piece called Becoming Woman, which is about a bus journey and the whole business of giving up seats and, the gendered nature of that. Who do you give up your seat for? Very inspirational story. We've got Greta Hurst, who's reading a piece called Love in Montreal about coming out in the 50s and what that was like. So it's quite a mixed performance. Some very funny, some very poignant, some pieces that do both.
Yeah, it definitely looks like a very diverse and well-balanced view of the arts and also of different perspectives as well.
Yep. We've also got actually a PowerPoint presentation, which is just a little bit about the history of the group over the last 6 years and some of the things that we've achieved.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if we can also touch on the importance of the intergenerational difference here and what new perspectives that's brought to the group for this cabaret.
Well, it's not entirely new for us. We had we've really fostered relationships with younger queers. We've had some collaborations with GAB Youth.
Mm-hmm.
One of our community partners is Community.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done some writing workshops and some joint performances with GAB Youth. We've also had several members, Gail, our transsexual member being one of them, who went out to talk to classes at UBC in CSIS, Critical Studies in Sexuality.
Right.
And, it's a very interesting relationship. For some of our members who are older, they don't have grandchildren or they don't have the relationship that they would like with grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
Either because of family issues or because they're just members of the gay diaspora, right, and they don't live near their families.
Mm-hmm.
And for some younger people, I think, the obvious thing is that there is a lack of role models. They perhaps don't have the relationship they would like with their grandparents. So the more we can bridge that gap and build relationships, strong relationships in the queer community, the better.
Mm-hmm.
I also think there's a lot of history in this group that isn't being documented because it's not mainstream history.
Mm-hmm.
It is history on the margins. And there are some great initiatives locally, like the Queer History Project and the Lesbian Herstory Project out of Simon Fraser. The Gay and Lesbian Archives is another such project. But I think the more that we can record our histories and make it entertaining and something that people like to come out and listen to, you know, the better educated we all become.
Definitely. It's a different view of history for sure, and one that's equally as important and doesn't get nearly enough coverage.
Yeah, well, one of our mentors actually is Wason Choi, the famous Canadian memoirist and novelist.
Mm-hmm.
And in the introduction to one of our biographies, one of our anthologies, sorry, you know, Wason just said that how important these stories are, how important it is to have an archive that doesn't represent the normative view of history that, you know, we've all been spoon-fed.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll see more of that going into the future, and I'm sure the cabaret is a great start to that as well.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody's welcome. We're sharing the proceeds with out in schools, you know, anything that we make over and above goes half to out in schools and half to Quirky.
Mm-hmm.
And we think it's going to be a fun event. We usually, we've got a cash bar, and usually after the actual show, we crank up some tunes and dance in our various capacities. Some of us dance on scooters, and some of us dance the regular way, but the Quirkies sure know how to have a good time. They're a very fun group. I love working with them.
Well, hopefully us or some of our listeners will be able to make it out there.
I hope so. Come on down.
Yeah, well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today. It was great learning about Quirky and what you're doing.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Claire. Another Claire. We Claire should stick together, right?
It's true. We should.
Okay, thanks so much.
Well, thank you. Take care.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
And that was Claire Robson, the artistic director for Quirky, which stands for the Queer Imaging and Writing Collective for Elders, talking about their queer cabaret that will be happening on Wednesday, June 13th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Roundhouse Community Center. The show starts at 7 p.m. and it's at the door by donation.
Welcome back to CATR 101.9 FM, broadcasting out the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. You're listening to News 101. And next on the program, we go to Democracy Now! With an interview with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz on Occupy Wall Street and why the U.S.-Europe austerity will only weaken economic recovery. And now, Democracy Now!
The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Nermeen, maybe we should talk about working women.
Joseph Stiglitz, you have spoken about the austerity measures that have been imposed across Europe, or that are being considered across Europe, and you've said that they are, quote, a suicide pact. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, in Europe, these measures of austerity are going to make the countries weaker and weaker. I predicted that when Europe began that back in 2010 in Greece, when the Greek crisis first emerged. What's happened is Greece has become successfully weaker and weaker, to the point where the youth unemployment now is 50%. Political turmoil is breaking out. I said the same thing when Spain began that process. And now in Spain, the youth unemployment rate is again 50%, and the unemployment overall has gone well over 20%. And just yesterday, you know, Spain's conservative government has said, we can't deal with it, even though they had run on a platform of, oh, you've messed up with economic policy. So the point is that we've done this experiment in austerity over and over again. The first example, you might say, in modern history was Herbert Hoover, when he responded to the stock market crash by austerity under the influence of his Secretary of Treasury, Andrew Mellon, and we had the Great Depression. The IMF forested in East Asia and Korea and Thailand and Indonesia, and we saw the consequences. The economies went down. Why Europe is repeating this experiment where we know almost for certain what the outcome is, and it's turning out to be exactly as I predicted.
I mean, is it only Europe? Let's turn to the federal budget here. Republicans who control the House have been calling for cuts to food aid, health care, other social services, while protecting funds for the Pentagon. This is House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan speaking last month.
What we're saying is let's get on growth and prevent
austerity. The whole premise of our budget is to preempt austerity by getting our borrowing under control, having tax reform for economic growth, and preventing Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid from going bankrupt. That preempts austerity. The president, his budget, the fact the Senate hasn't done a budget in 3 years, puts us on a path toward European-like austerity. That's what we're trying to prevent from happening in the first place.
That's House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan of Wisconsinite, like Governor Scott Walker. Your response, Joe Stiglitz. Well,
the good thing about what he said is austerity is finally getting a bad name. Then the question is, what are the policies? And what he's proposing is weakening our basic economic fiber. If you don't invest in education, technology, infrastructure,
where do you get the money?
The economy gets weaker. Well, the good news is that right now, the markets are willing to lend to the U.S. at essentially zero interest rate, long-term interest rates of 1.5%. You know, if you were a business and you could borrow at 1.5% or zero for investments with very high returns, you'd be foolish not to do it. The right keeps focusing on just one side of the country's balance sheet or the government's balance sheet, what they owe. They don't look at the other side, the assets. And it's the assets that are really important if we're going to have long-term economic growth. So it's like a company that says, let's cut out our R&D budget. Let's cut out all our investment. And you know where that company is going to go? It's going to go into the tubes. And that's his recommendation for America. I think that's wrong. It's not the way you're going to get growth.
Yeah, you've also said that if Romney, if the Republicans win the elections in November, that that would significantly raise the likelihood of a recession.
Well, the Republicans have been consistently focused on cutbacks. Americans don't realize that we already have begun austerity. There are about 1 million fewer public sector employees than there were before the crisis. The standard recommendation of macroeconomics, of economic, is that when the private sector gets weak, government is supposed to step in, fill the breach, and stimulate the economy so that the economy is stabilized, because the private sector is very volatile. But we've been doing just the opposite. As the private sector has gotten weaker, we've kept out 1 million jobs. What the Republicans would do is make those cutbacks even bigger. And the result, and Wisconsin is an example, you know, more cutbacks of public employees. And the result of that is our economy is going to go down further into the hole. In the context of Europe, very likely going into turmoil, there is going to be a risk of a significant downturn. And those policies then increase the probability of our weak economy tipping over into recession.
Joe Stiglitz, yesterday, every single Republican in the Senate voted against the Paycheck Fairness Act, so it cannot move forward. Explain what this act is, the significance of this for working women.
Well, this is one of the issues that I take up in my book, not the particular bill, but what is distinctive about American inequality is that too much goes to the very top. That's the 1%. The middle has been hollowed out, and the bottom is doing very badly. The number of poverty are increasing. Well, when you look at what's happening at the middle and the bottom, one of the factors that contributes to weaknesses in the middle and the bottom is discrimination. Women get paid, on average, less than 80% of men of the same qualifications doing the same kind of work. You know, that's discrimination, and that weakens the economic fiber of our country, and it creates more inequality. And this bill was an attempt to circumscribe that kind of discrimination. Things are better than they were 30 years ago. We've made progress. But what is clear that in spite of our awareness of this kind of discrimination, we haven't closed the gap. We have a lot more to do.
Particularly among African-American and Latino women.
Very much so. And, you know, one of the aspects of the crisis, we now realize that the banks targeted Afro-American and Latinos for these predatory lending, bad loans, high transaction costs. And one of the consequences of that discrimination, and the banks have paid very large fines and settlements of claims against that kind of discrimination, the consequence is the wealth of those at the bottom who are Afro-American, who are Hispanics, Latinos, have been wiped out. And so we had a bigger gap in wealth than the gap in income. You know, I mentioned that the top 1% gets 20% of all the income. They have about 40% of the wealth. You look at the wealth gaps in Latinos and Afro-Americans, it's so much larger and really unconscionable.
And your comments on Occupy Wall Street, you write about that in your book as well.
Well, Occupy Wall Street was a reflection of a lot of Americans' perspective that our economic system is unfair. The protest movement that began in Tunisia was partly about lack of jobs, but it was partly, I went to Tunisia, it was unfairness in our system. There was a hope after the crisis that government would fix things. It didn't, or it didn't do enough. And that combination of economic unfairness and a political system that doesn't seem capable of correcting these injustices, I think is what motivated a lot of the Occupy Wall Street.
I want to go to a clip of Bloomberg talking about Occupy Wall Street, saying Wall Street is a critical tax base for New York City. This is during his weekly radio address last October.
The protests that are trying to destroy the jobs of working people in the city aren't productive. And some of the labor unions, the municipal unions that are participating, they're salaries come from the taxes paid by the people that they're trying to vilify.
What say you, Joe Stiglitz?
I think he's 100% wrong. I mean, basically, the fundamentals of a democracy are that you want people to express their views. They had hoped that the politicians would hear their voice. They had hoped that the politicians would address the inequalities in our society, the deficiencies in our financial system. And what became increasingly clear was that money was driving politics, which is an important point that I raise in the book. Money shapes markets. Markets, don't exist in a vacuum. The way markets work is based on rules and regulation that come out of Congress. And when politics shapes those rules and regulations to help the 1% rather than to help the rest of our society, something is wrong. And what the protest movement was, out of frustration, a sense that the Democratic politics didn't reflect the view of the majority of Americans, you might say of the 99%. And
do you want to see it grow bigger? You were down there at Occupy.
I think it's very important that somehow we get a politics that reflects the interest of the majority of Americans. When we have a bankruptcy law, for instance, that says that first priority goes to derivatives, that encourages speculation in the financial markets. And when we have a bankruptcy law that says students cannot discharge their debt, no matter how bad an education the for-profit schools give them, there's something wrong.
We're going to talk to you for a few minutes in post-show. Put it online at democracynow.org about what are the most important things to do right now. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joe Stiglitz, professor at Columbia University. The new book is The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berger, Nate Feltzer, Armante Namiche, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcock, Hani Masood, Ravi Karandina, Bester, Chantal Berman, and Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Good.
Thanks to Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman for that national story. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at democracynow.org. And that is our show for today, which is June 8th, Friday. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you would like to share your comments or get involved or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. Or you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website at citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday at 5 for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Iqbal Ahmed. Today's show is produced by Claire
Iqbal.
Eagle and Iqbal the Fire Ahmed. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded.
On CITR, 101.9 FM.